urine, either urine or blood, when in control of the vessel?
I think your question concerns...
Ron Cornett has ended the Exxon press conference. After this conference began, we received notice from a Coast Guard spokesman that the NTSB is holding a press conference that should be starting almost immediately. The National Transportation Safety Board, again, is conducting the investigation of the grounding that actually occurred. Again, we have been told that the NTSB briefing will be beginning in just a moment. This meeting was unscheduled and unannounced previously. We got the word during this press conference and were unable to get the word down the line earlier. We will continue broadcasting and we will carry the NTSB press briefing as soon as it does get underway. We've just been listening to a broadcast of the Exxon morning briefing, this one attended by Don Cornett of Exxon out of the Anchorage office, and George Nelson, who is the president of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. They each had a few of their personnel with them. Chuck O'Donnell, who is the superintendent of the Marine Terminal, in attendance with George Nelson, and some other assistants whose identity I don't know, assisting or backing up Don Cornett. The briefing this morning, the high points while we're waiting for the NTSB briefing to start, 475,000 barrels of crude oil from the Exxon Valdez has been transferred to the Exxon Baton Rouge, which has left. It's heading down to California. We're not sure whether it's Bay Area or Long Beach to an Exxon refinery. The Exxon San Francisco is pulling alongside. It did come into Port Valdez to the Alyeska terminal, deballasting through the terminal's ballast water treatment center. It is now back out in the Valdez Arm, Bly Island area. It's in the process of pulling side the Exxon Baton Rouge, or pardon me, the Exxon Valdez, to pick up the lightering efforts that were being conducted by the Exxon Baton Rouge. They anticipate two more days before the Exxon San Francisco will be full and will then at that time be replaced by the Exxon Baytown to finish to complete the lightering if there is any more needed. The lightering effort is now at a rate of 10,000 barrels per hour. Don Cornett indicated that skimming and boom operations are continuing, that there are 42,000 feet of protective boom on site, 33,600 feet of absorbent boom, 33,000 feet, excuse me, and about 2,400 feet of fire boom. That's used for the burning attempts. The announcement today was that by Don Cornett of Exxon that no dispersants will be applied today and that no more use of dispersant is anticipated on the spill that occurred a week ago. The oil has been in the water now. This is the seventh day. The oil has been in the water for 6 days and some hours. It is no longer can be effectively dispersed. Also, it has moved into areas where dispersant use is prohibited or at least severely restricted. However, and in another response, Cornett indicated that if there are any additional spills, if the Exxon Valdez were to shift or break up or to release more fresh oil, that dispersant would be immediately applied as the tanker is sitting in a Zone 1 dispersant area. Burning has not been successful, but they will continue attempts. Beach cleanup concentration will be on Naked Island, Eleanor Island, Night Island, and Bly Island. And however, work has not begun yet. Exxon has announced that in concert with various environmental groups and DEC, they're moving slowly to establish base camps and begin work. The first effort is to get the oil off the Exxon Valdez, salvage the vessel, skim off the oil in the water now, contain it away from the beaches, and once they have gotten the oil out of the water, then move on to the beaches to pick up the oil that was missed. Now, there's a special survey going on this afternoon, throughout the day rather, for birds and mammals. A claims office has been set up in Valdez. There will soon to be one in Cordova as well. We were told that tonight, 6 p.m. Exxon briefing, that Frank Arossi, the president of Exxon Shipping, and Bill Stevens, the president of Exxon USA, will be in attendance. George Nelson also spoke mostly in response to questions. We'll get into that a little later, but right now here is William Woody, spokesman for the NTSB.
I'd just like to introduce myself. My name is Drusella Anderson. I am the press officer for the National Transportation Safety Board. If any of you would like to reach me, I'm staying at the Village Inn, and I'll make myself available to you here. Most of you probably know Bill Woody, the investigator in charge of this investigation already. He's going to make a brief statement. I would ask you to please not to interrupt him in the middle of his statement. He'll answer all your questions after he finishes. William Woody. W-O-O-D-Y.
Good morning. We are going to release the results of the toxicology test, but we will not discuss their meaning. The toxicology test had been received and showed the presence of alcohol in two individuals. The first individual, a civilian employee of the U.S. Coast Guard, who stands watch in the vessel traffic center. His tests, based on a urine sample, indicate a percentage of 0.2% alcohol. This man was on watch at the time of the casualty from midnight until 11:45 the next day. Interviews with the man have disclosed that he left the Coast Guard about 11:15, arrived at his home at 12 o'clock. He did have some drinks, ate his lunch, and went to bed fully expecting not to be on watch until 2400 midnight that night. He was, however, called from sleep, recalled to the Coast Guard station for testing. Upon his arrival, he informed the commanding officer that he had been drinking. The commanding officer stated that he did observe that the man had signs of having been drinking, but he elected to conduct the test anyway. The second individual is the master of the Exxon Valdez. Some background regarding the test results are, based on a urine sample, 0.09. The blood, 0.061% alcohol. Be pleased to. Based on the urine sample, 0.09, 9 is a niner, blood, 0.061. Some background information may be relevant. When Coast Guard officers arrived on board the Exxon Valdez at about 02:30, the investigating officer, the Coast Guard officer, smelled what he believed was alcohol on the master's breath. He described the smell as strong. He said, however, that the captain appeared to act normally. Attempts were immediately started by the Coast Guard to have a medically qualified person come to the vessel to take samples for tox testing. There is no health service technician, better known as a hospital corpsman, at the U.S. Coast Guard Valdez base. At about 06:30, a state trooper from the Alaska Fish and Game came on board the Exxon Valdez, to assist the Coast Guard, but he had no facilities to take test samples. A U.S. Coast Guard health service technician had been at the U.S. Coast Guard base checking medical records the day before. He was located about 0900 as he was preparing to board an outbound flight. He was transported to the vessel and took test between 09:30 and approximately 11:30. The persons involved were the lookout on watch, the quartermaster on watch, who was steering the vessel, the third mate, and the master. This concludes my statement.
Now, is there a way of calculating, according to the person's body weight, size, etc., what his level would have been at the point of impact? that we have such a low figure for so many hours later?
Just said that we said we would give the results and do the interpretation.
We've given you the results, and we would like not to comment on their meaning or interpretation.
Is the technology available to you? I mean, are there figures that can be used to determine what approximately his level would have been at impact? Is that a possibility?
Well, different activities do have different rules of thumb that they use to back the results back, take the results and back. But I would not like to speculate on what the results might be, what the estimated results might be.
What the particular function with Coast Guard civilian employee was performing in the watch center at the time?
Yes, he was the watch center on watch. And as I mentioned, he was on his normal tour of duty was midnight until 8 o'clock the next morning. And he was asked to volunteer to stay another 4 hours, and he did so. I would like to mention that his conduct performance was observed closely during this time by the commanding officer of the station, by the executive officer of the station, early when he was called in before going out to the ship, a warrant officer who was also called in and who went to the ship, who was in very close contact with him at this time. We've interviewed the person whom he relieved, and based on the interviews of these persons, they all claim his performance was efficient, effective, typical, and no indication of any impairment.
Did he have any responsibility towards the radar and keeping track of the ship on the radar?
He did indeed. He was the one operating the radar.
Could you please give us his name, his current status with the Coast Guard, and his job title?
His name is Bruce Blandford.
Spell it.
B-L-A-N-D-F-O-R-D.
What is rank, sir?
He's a civil service employee. I did not have his grade.
Mr. Woody, just to restate so we understand, you're saying that this Mr. Blandford came to work Wednesday night, went on the job at midnight Wednesday, stayed on the job until throughout Wednesday, and I'm sorry, came on the job Wednesday night, was on the job all night, all day Thursday. And was supposed to leave at 8 p.m. Thursday, left instead at midnight Thursday.
No.
Run that.
Okay. His normal watch was midnight to 8.
Right. Midnight Thursday.
Right, and the collision happened a few minutes after midnight.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
When he arrived, he told his commander.
Oh, excuse me. So he came on work just a little bit before the collision.
That's correct.
Midnight Thursday night.
That's correct.
And right. He was on duty until 8 a.m. Friday.
Right.
And he stayed on duty until noon.
Till noon, right.
And then he went home.
Had lunch.
And his information to you was he had a few drinks.
That's
before
correct.
He went to bed. Mm-hmm. And then they woke him up when? What time?
About 2 o'clock.
About 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, he arrived back at the Coast Guard station about 2 o'clock.
Okay, right. Fine. So he's had his drinks. He's started to get to sleep. He's woken up. He goes back. He gets the drug test. He tells the people, give him the test. He's had some drinks after he got off duty.
He explained that he had been drinking, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Did he say that he had drinks before he reported to duty with dinner the night before?
He said he did not.
Is there a regulation of any sort, government, civilian, that limits the amount of alcohol that could appear in either urine or blood when in control of the vessel?
I think your question concerns civilian personnel, and I don't know of any.
I'm talking about the master.
The master for the... A limit of 0.04% or above is considered too high a level of alcohol for a person to be in charge of a vessel like the Valdez.
Now, that's point for what? Urine or blood, sir?
Of that limit, correct? He clearly was in violation of that even 9 hours after the incident.
I'm sorry.
Is that number again, please?
0.04%.
Blood.
But
under what law?
What was the level detected?
0.06.
0.061.
So the blood and urine were higher than the limit considered safe to operate that tanker.
Could you so state that, please?
Is that right?
That's correct.
And that's a Coast Guard regulation or what?
That is a Coast Guard regulation.
Is being higher than that regulation mean necessarily some sort of penalty?
Enforcement of the regulation, as I previously stated, is a Coast Guard responsibility.
Yeah.
Coast Guard has that responsibility.
Is it automatic in the same way that driving over .08, for example, would mean some sort of prosecution? Is it that sort of automatic threshold? Therefore, there's no way to have a limit, reading of more than .04 without being charged and prosecuted in some way.
It wouldn't be proper to speak on behalf of the Coast Guard. That is an enforcement problem, and clearly that's the responsibility of the Coast Guard.
Is your investigation centering on this alcohol now?
Let's see, may I take a question over here, I believe?
Yes, sir. Can you tell me if the board is familiar with the vessels enough to answer this question? Is each one of these vessels, and I'm not referring to the Coast Guard's monitoring station, but does each individual ship have two independent radar sets?
This ship is required to have two radar sets, and it does have.
And were both of those sets working at the time of the collision?
They are both functioning.
Does the board know the range? Can you give these people an idea what the range of those sets are? Are they 24, 32, 48 mile sets?
I don't know the effective range of the radar, but it was adequate to reach all landmarks necessary for the navigation of the vessel.
Is it safe to assume that they were quite possibly 48-mile radars?
I don't know that it's safe to say that.
Mr. Woody,
thank you.
I say that Mr. Hazelwood, Captain Hazelwood, was still in violation of Coast Guard regulations even 9 hours after the accident. We need you to make a statement to that effect, if you would, please.
Well, I've given you the standard in the regulations, what the upper limit is, of 0.04%.
For blood or urine?
I believe it's blood.
So the captain was shot, right? As
so
far as your terms
his were? Level, as we can mathematically see, is higher than that.
That does not necessarily mean he was legally drunk. Is it not 0.10?
No. We're just simply saying that the regulations say that the person in charge of a vessel must have a blood alcohol content, something below 0.04. 0.04 and above are too high.
Mr. Woody, in light of that, can you say whether the captain of this vessel was driving an oil tanker while intoxicated?
We can't say that because at that time the ship had been aground many hours. So it's...
Did he have something to drink after the collision?
We cannot say because we have not been able to interview the captain regarding the events of that evening.
Did you say that the blood was taken sometime between 9:30 and 11:30?
That's correct. Probably closer to 11 o'clock.
The exact time was not documented?
The Exxon press briefing this morning has been followed by an NTSB Coast Guard press briefing. William Woody. Bill Woody, the spokesman for the NTSB, is responding to questions now. He's looking for some answers. Here he is again.
I didn't happen to bring the time with me, but the time is a matter of record, and we can provide that.
Mr. Woody, can I get you to clarify one more time? The relationship between the standard of Coast Guard enforcement of blood alcohol and the level that was in the captain's test for me?
I believe you again asked me to comment on Coast Guard enforcement.
I want you to state what the difference was, the Coast Guard standard, and what was present. Tested.
You mean the presence of the first person whom I read?
The captain.
I don't believe I can comment on that.
Mr. Woody, you have commented on it, sir. What we'd like you to do is comment on it in one sentence.
One figure in relation to another.
Just tell us what the standard is. Tell us what you found in the blood.
Two facts and link it together in a nice sound bite for us.
Come on, you've got to be obvious.
All right. The standard I quoted was 0.04, and the blood level in the captain's blood was 0.061.
How many hours after the collision?
Approximately 10 and a half hours.
Mr. Whitty, are you saying that there was no evidence of blood of alcohol in the tests of Mr. Cousins or Mr. Kagan, and that there was no evidence of any drugs in the samples from Mr. Cousins, Mr. Kagan, and Mr. Woody?
And Mr. Who, please?
My profound apologies, Captain Hazelwood.
There was no indication of blood in any of the other individuals tested, and that was the lookout on watch, the quartermaster on watch, or the third mate, Mr. Cousins.
Could you go over just once again a bit about being picked up at the airport?
Yes, I can. The point I made was that the Coast Guard has no corpsman. However, there was a corpsman that they were looking for who had been there to take and to conduct an inspection the previous day. Surely. The question regarded the Coast Guard resources. As I mentioned, the Coast Guard has no hospital corpsman. And however, there was a hospitalman who had been there conducting an inspection of health records. They were looking for him. They found him at 9 o'clock in the morning when he was leaving and preparing to leave on a flight.
And he was the only guy that could administer the test.
The only one they could find at that time.
This is at 9 in the morning?
9 in the morning they found him.
Could you go over once again the sequence of events with the captain when he told Mr. Blanford, I believe? What was that about the drinking in the afternoon?
Mr. Blanford stood a long watch. He went home. Didn't expect to go on watch again until midnight. He had some drinks, he ate his lunch, he went to bed.
This is all after the accident?
All after the accident.
Was it clear that Mr. Blanford...
More than 12 hours after the accident.
Was it clear that Mr. Blanford went off duty not knowing that there had been a collision on the reef?
Oh, indeed not. That's why he was asked to stay 4 more hours to assist. You mean at the time he didn't know?
I'm sorry, excuse me, you're absolutely right. So he knew, he just stayed up longer. I'm sorry.
Would we have any witnesses told the NTSB that they observed Captain Hazelwood drinking before before he boarded the ship or when he was on the ship?
In one of our interviews, there was indication of some drinking on one occasion, undated, sometime in the past.
Let me ask you a question. On ship.
On board ship.
The Coast Guard officer came on board right after the spill.
Well,
2:30 in the morning.
2:30.
Did he smell alcohol in the captain's breath? I asked you 2 days ago, did he do something? Did he say anything to the captain? You know, if he took any action or he said anything verbally to the captain once he had smelled the alcohol?
That I don't know, but I know that they started trying to get somebody to go out and take the test.
Mr. Whitty,
they started calling ashore, the Coast Guard officers, attempting to get a qualified medical person to come out and take the test. It requires someone who's qualified to take a blood sample.
The pilot said he did not smell alcohol on Captain Hazelwood's breath when he disembarked.
He said that sometime during the transfer of Valdez, he did smell what could have been the smell of alcohol on the captain's breath.
Is it true from the time of the grounding until the time Mr. Cousins and Mr. Hazelwood had their samples taken, they remained on the vessel?
They were on the vessel from the time.
They were on the vessel, and they were on the vessel when the tests were taken.
That's correct.
They did not leave the vessel.
Did not leave.
And is it also true that to this date, you have found no evidence of alcohol on the vessel?
We have not.
So will you search the captain's cabin?
We have not.
You have not searched the captain's cabin?
Why not?
Well, the captain's cabin has been completely occupied by a relief master from Exxon, provided by Exxon, of course. Another Exxon master to assist that master. There have been company representatives using the office spaces, so the spaces are pretty well utilized. I don't think that any testing would be meaningful. I mean, any search would be meaningful or required.
Is it unusual that, given your suspicions in this case, that you wouldn't search for evidence, material evidence?
I really can't give you a qualitative answer to that. We are certainly concerned about the quality of a person and his ability to perform, but we're interested in all parts of the accident.
Are you going to make any other efforts to compel or encourage the testimony of the third mate and the captain, or are you satisfied that you're not going to be able to get them to say anything?
No, we're optimistic. We anticipate that we will eventually acquire the information from these two individuals.
Is that based on a legal assault in terms of, are your lawyers working on getting them to compel them to testify?
We are not working on anything to make them testify, nor are we working on any immunity for them. But we do hope that after their attorneys have reviewed the various statutes that could affect their clients, that they will permit them to meet with us and to describe the events of that meeting.
Are there other agencies?
Have the crewmen testified or refused to testify?
They have all testified and have been very helpful and very cooperative.
Are other agencies trying to compel them to testify, sir?
Pardon me?
Are other agencies attempting to compel them to testify?
I don't know. I would suspect so, but I don't know.
Has their testimony shed light on what happened and why the accident occurred and whether the captain was drinking?
Not while the captain was drinking, but it has said some light of the accident, and I did reveal that Wednesday, namely that their statements, the course recorder fixed on the chart, did reveal that the vessel was on a course of 180, a course which would take it further away from the traffic separation scheme, separation lines, into the position of the collision, of the aggressive grounding.
Sir, did you give your analysis to the third, or to the engineer, since he's down in the engine room?
We did not.
And why not?
The engines were functioning correctly. They were on bridge control. And there was no indication of any engineering problem.
The order is given to the engineer, to be able to control this.
This was on, I should have said, bridge control. In other words, on the bridge, you move the handle and you directly control the engine in the engine room. So there was no human involvement in answering the bells.
Mr. Cousins was not the officer of the watch.
Let's see, I can take a middle one here.
Mr. Cousins was not the officer of the watch, as I understand it, when the course correction was made. Is this correct?
No, he was the officer when the course...
So he was
Some course change was made, which brought them outside the channel. He was on watch at that time.
For the whole duration,
Yes, the time the ship left port until the grounding.
Mr. Woody, have your investigators interviewed the cab drivers that took the crew to the terminal or other civilian personnel that may be able to say whether the captain was drinking?
Yes, they have. Interviewed one cab driver who drove three individuals back to the vessel about the time that it could have been the master, the radio officer, and the chief engineer.
He could not
say yes or no. All he said was that they appeared to be all right.
Did he pick them up at the pipeline club?
I believe that's where he said he picked them up, but he was unable to identify who they were, and he said that he saw nothing unusual in their performance or conduct.
Was he sure it was the master and the...
No, he was not.
Mr. Woody,
you believe it was the master?
Standard, does it matter that the...
Okay, I'll get back to you, sir.
In applying that .04 standard, does it matter that the captain was not actually in charge of the vessel at the time?
Oh, he wasn't actually... He was actually in charge of the vessel.
He was not on the bridge.
The master is always has responsibility for his vessel.
Where he is on
that. Yes.
Who is it that told you they had seen him drink on board before?
The statement of the pilot. You said...
Excuse me just for a moment. Just one second.
Could you repeat the pilot's statement to us as to the condition of the captain?
When asked, he said that he smelled what he believed was alcohol, but he saw nothing to indicate that the captain was affected by alcohol.
This is the pilot.
The pilot.
Could you address the previous question? Do you know who was it that told you that they had thought he had seen him drinking at some previous occasion?
Radio officer.
Radio officer?
Radio officer.
Do you know how recently that was that he
didn't see that? He could not remember a date.
He said he was drunk.
Oh, no. He saw him drinking.
The same captain was drinking?
Same captain.
On board the vessel.
Are they allowed to have any alcohol in their room or drink with dinner on board a ship like that?
I don't know what I don't have any federal regulations in this regard, and I don't know what the company's regulations are. I would direct
that. Excellent. A couple of days ago, that is against their regulation. There's absolutely no alcohol allowed on the ship. That's why I still have the question. Considering that someone has seen that master drinking on the ship before, and it is totally against company regulations, why wasn't his room searched? That does not make sense to me. Why has there been no search for physical evidence, considering that 10 hours later his blood alcohol level was above what it should have been? It's very possible that he could have been drinking, or he had to have contained a lot of alcohol before he got on. Why was no search made for physical evidence?
I cannot answer that question, except to say that when I did arrive on the vessel, the captain's quarters were occupied by a great number of excellent persons, including a new master of the vessel. I would presume that any search at that time, you know, there's so much moving and changing of things in the room, you know, files and so forth. I don't know if there have been any expectations of anything.
Did the radio officer say what he had seen the captain drinking on board?
I beg pardon?
Did the radio officer say what type of drink he saw the captain drinking?
He couldn't identify it.
Was it spirits or was it beer?
He said that he mixed it with orange juice. Didn't taste it.
Was that on the bridge or...?
Wait, was he drinking of alcohol a contributing factor to this accident?
It's too, it would be premature to say something like that. We're going to do a lot of studying before we come up with a conclusion and a probable cause for the accident.
Is it a given that, I mean, if a captain has a heart attack on a ship, I mean, is it a given then that nobody else is qualified to operate this ship and you're going to drive these ships into a reef? What's the level of redundancy of the electronics on the ship? What kind of electronics did you have functioning? Were they all functioning? Shouldn't they have known precisely? And shouldn't the man who was operating the ship be qualified to know precisely within literally meters with satellite navigation where he was at any given point? How would the love of God that he run into a reef the size of Rhode Island?
The very questions you're asking are the pretty well identify much of the scope of our investigation. We were in the status of
electronics. Were they functioning?
Yes, indeed they were. Are you
trying to nail a guy for being drunk when you should have people that know how to operate a ship, and you should have a redundancy in electronics that shouldn't drive a ship into Rhode Island?
Please understand that the function of the safety board is to determine the cause of the accident.
Should the ship be able to function with the captain inebriated, with a heart attack, dead on the bridge, or whatever? Should that ship be able to not hit that reef? Are there other people that are qualified? Are the electronic systems capable?
There's so many questions.
Mr. Woody, your failure to search the captain's cabin, is it that in part because the chain of evidence would have been corrupted by the presence of these other individuals?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry that I indicated that somehow. No, I didn't then and don't now feel need for a search of the captain's cabin.
Mr. Woody, is it true that Commander Falkenstein or Officer DeLosier or the Fish and Wildlife Protection Officer found two empty drink mixer bottles in the captain's cabin?
We have been asking for the state trooper to come by so we can interview him. We have not been able to arrange a suitable time to interview the state trooper, and we still await his making an appointment with us.
Did somebody find empty drink mixer bottles in the captain's cabin?
I'm not aware of that.
Does your optimism that the captain will eventually talk to you based in part on your own reading of the statutes that seem to indicate fairly mild punishment for whatever he might have done?
Our main purpose is to determine the cause of the accident, and as I repeatedly said, enforcement is a Coast Guard function. Back to your question, if I may just say one thing, the captain did volunteer two bottles of non-alcoholic beer. We do have those two bottles as a sample. They say non-alcoholic, it's a brand called Moosey. I believe the percent, and this is from memory, is something like 0.05. I should not think, but it's very low. It's a point something percent.
Did your investigators discover that the captain had visited bars in Valdez between noon and 7 p.m. drinking a small quantity of beer and a lot of iced tea? Was that reported to you?
I have heard that. If information is available, from other witnesses, we would welcome their cooperation in our investigation.
Secretary Skinner said this morning at a news conference at the White House that the ship was traveling at 15 knots, which conflicts with what you've been telling us.
We have not determined the speed, but it would appear to be less than that.
But more than 8. You originally told us 8.
I'm not sure I said 8, but the vessel was increasing speed gradually pursuant to a computer, which was going to take up to the maximum sea speed, the established sea speed.
Well,
I'm not prepared right now to say just where we think the RPM was to get the particular turns to the water.
Was he speeding?
No.
Quite a bit back.
We have no indication of any speeding.
Mr. Woody, in your experience of investigating these kind of accidents with involving tankers, have you in your experience found masters of ships who have been over the limit before, or is this the first time you've come across
them? I think you must realize that this is a new area, the testing.
There was one accident in 1990.
William Woody is being briefed by Giselle Anderson, the new PIO from the NTSB, before he answers his question. Again, this is an NTSB briefing that is conducted after the Exxon press conference.
One case that did involve alcohol. And she's getting the case now.
Can you give the state of Alaska the records that they've asked the safety board for?
We've given
they were copies of the ship's logs, navigational charts. Earlier, the safety board had refused to give them up to the state investigators for their criminal investigation.
Those records have been transmitted to the state.
Is there any impact on the accident due to the fact that there was a shift change on the radar operation just before the actual impact?
I'm not prepared to answer that, but that is one of the areas that we're investigating into.
Have you heard whether the oncoming man was given a briefing by the man that was leaving watch?
He was indeed.
And he was aware of the ship?
He was aware there was a ship outbound.
And was he seeing it on radar?
He was not.
Was the man who left the ship seeing it on radar?
He had been for some time until it started becoming intermittent.
Did he report that he couldn't see it on radar anymore to the oncoming man?
I think his report was that it was not always readable on radar. It was outbound, appeared to be normal, operating in outside of its established lane, going into the northbound lane to avoid ice.
Once again, Bill Woody is being briefed by the PIO from the NTSB.
Ms. Anderson has provided me with some information regarding one previous accident investigated by the board that did involve alcohol impairment. This was the ferry George Prince, Mississippi River, 1976, collided with a tanker with high loss of life. And the operator of the Prince George, the ferry boat, was under the influence of alcohol.
Where was that?
Mississippi River.
And what do you know what the outcome was by way of penalty?
I do not. As again, we are interested in determining the cause of accidents.
Any idea how much alcohol was in that captain's?
Not, I do not.
That was before testing. Thank you very much.
And with that, thank you. Giselle Anderson, the NTSB PIO, or Public Information Officer, who has arrived, rather abruptly curtailed this press conference. If I can gather my notes here, this was some of the rather startling revelations. William Woody, the NTSB spokesman, indicated that of the various blood tests administered, or alcohol test, I should say, both blood and urine samples, that there was a positive result in two of the tests. One of them was on the civilian radar operator who was on watch at the time of the incident. However, the civilian employee was not tested until about 2 o'clock the following afternoon. That would have been 2 o'clock Good Friday. When brought in for testing at 2 in the afternoon, the employee indicated that he had had a drink with lunch after he came off of an extended watch. As a result, that test may be inconclusive as far as inferences that can be drawn. However, the startling revelation today, not really a surprise, but a shock nonetheless, was that 10 and a half hours after the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, the master of the vessel, Hazelwood, still showed a blood alcohol percent of 0.061. Urinalysis revealed a blood or an alcohol content of 0.09. Coast Guard regulations indicate that a blood alcohol level of 0.04 or above is too high for a master of a vessel or someone to operate a vessel such as the Exxon Valdez. Again, the captain of the Exxon Valdez having a blood alcohol level of 0.061 10 and a half hours after the accident, when a blood level of 0.04 or above would be a violation of Coast Guard regulations. Also, revelations at this press conference that the captain had been observed drinking on board the Exxon Valdez at least once, that admission attributed to the vessel's radio officer, and that drinking on board would also have been a direct violation of Exxon company policy, while that may not have been specifically a violation of U.S. or maritime law. Questions following from the press largely dealt with specifics of trying to pin down the NTSB, I think as much to get a good sound bite as to find information, getting William Woody to reveal all the information in one concise sentence. Some interesting side lights to the alcohol test. Both the pilot going off the vessel shortly before, about 40 minutes before the grounding, the pilot required to navigate the vessel out of Port Valdez indicated that there was evidence of something that could have been alcohol on the captain. However, the captain seemed to be functioning fine. The warrant officer Delosier, the first Coast Guard official on board the vessel, at 2 a.m., about an hour, hour and a half after the incident, reported a smell of alcohol on the captain's breath and put in a request for qualified personnel to administer blood and urine tests, alcohol and drug tests, to the captain. A state trooper responded from the Fish and Wildlife Agency at 6:30 in the morning. However, they had no kit. We heard the other day that there had been testing a kit on board the Exxon Valdez the whole time. Evidently, Exxon Shipping had put it there. However, none of the officials on board had been who came on board were notified that that kit was available. The Coast Guard problem in administering the test evidently seems to be waiting for qualified personnel, evidently to ensure the verifiability of the test. At 9 o'clock in the morning, Coast Guard medical corpsman, not stationed in the Valdez Coast Guard detachment, but visiting here on duty from some other Coast Guard post, conducting a periodic examination of Coast Guard base medical records, was intercepted at the airport as he was about to board a plane to leave, put in a helicopter and flown immediately to the Exxon Valdez. Again, tests began to be administered shortly after about 10 o'clock in the morning. So this marathon press conference, the Exxon morning briefing starting this morning at 11 o'clock, was followed immediately by an NTSB briefing that we had not been warned about in advance. The Exxon letting us know that the Baton Rouge, the tanker that came alongside the Exxon Valdez the day it grounded, has finally filled up, taking on 475,000 barrels of crude oil, about half, almost half of the oil estimated to be remaining on board. That was estimated to have remained on board the stricken tanker after it grounded. Half of that has now been removed to the Exxon Baton Rouge. It has left Prince William Sound, or is leaving Prince William Sound, heading to California to a refinery. The Exxon San Francisco, after deballasting in Port Valdez, is back at the ballast water treatment center at the Alyeska Pipeline Terminal, is heading and is moving alongside the Exxon Valdez to continue the lightering effort. Exxon company officials estimating that all of the oil should be off, or at least the Exxon San Francisco will be full within 2 days, Saturday morning. A small tanker, the Exxon Baytown, is standing by if there is a need for any further lightering effort following the filling of the Exxon San Francisco. Due to the submersible pumps in place, the Exxon, there is now a transfer rate from the stricken Exxon Valdez to what will presumably be the Exxon San Francisco in a few hours of about 10,000 barrels per hour. Skimming and booming will continue. There were reports again of what efforts are being undertaken. The big news is that as far as the Exxon briefing, no dispersants will be applied today. No more use of dispersants is anticipated at all for the oil that is currently spilled. However, there was it was made very clear by Exxon that if there is additional oil spill, if the tanker breaks up, or if there is additional spillage from the Exxon Valdez, the dispersant will be applied in the Zone 1 area where the tanker is resting. It should be noted that the area where the tanker is aground is Zone 1 only until April 1st, and following April 1st, that is right on the boundary of an area that becomes Zone 2 as the season progresses and the migration patterns of the various aquatic species, fish, herring, and such, move into the sound. The area where the tanker sits will no longer be Zone 1, but literally on the boundary line between a Zone 1 and Zone 2 area. Let's see, other than that, those were the main points of the briefing. Tonight, Exxon will be back at 6 o'clock, scheduled. And also, Frank Arossi, president of Exxon Shipping, and Bill Stevens, who is the head of Exxon USA, will be present at the evening briefing. Also scheduled tonight at 8 p.m., also that briefing is 6 p.m. Earlier had been announced at 5. It is 6 p.m., Alaska Standard Time. At 8 o'clock tonight, NOAA scheduled a conference. The note I have on my schedule sheet is that it's a joint federal, state, local. I assume these mean governmental agencies, representatives from federal regulatory and protection agencies, state agencies, and the local governments, and Exxon. So I suppose there is the possibility that the 6 o'clock conference will essentially be canceled and rolled into the big joint conference at 8. We'll see and advise stations and listeners as we get that information. So Exxon will be using no more dispersants unless additional oil is spilled. They are making good progress at last on the transfer of oil out of the Exxon Valdez. Tankers are standing by, and the big revelation, the master of the Exxon Valdez still had a blood alcohol level higher than allowed by Coast Guard regulations 10.5 hours after the conclusion, after the grounding incident on Bligh Reef. That confirmation by the NTSB today. None of the other crew members aboard the Exxon Valdez had any positive results on the alcohol tests that were administered to them. There was a positive alcohol result on the civilian employee who was standing radar watch at the Coast Guard Vessel Traffic Center, but that test was not administered until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, some 14 hours after the incident. The crew member had gone off shift 2 hours before the test and had indicated he had had lunch and drinks with at the time of going off shift. So there may be no inference we can make regarding alcohol contributing to the disaster, at least on the part of the watchstander. Further testimony or further investigation may or may not change that finding. I want to thank KCHU staffer Mary Beth Joyce for her assistance in this broadcast. Engineering these broadcasts back at the KCHU studios is James Winchester. I'm Dave Hammack, and this is the Alaska Public Radio Network.